This is Sandra Tanner, and you're listening to Gospel Tangents.
Shannon Flynn describes what it was like to work closely with Mark Hoffman, as well as what Mark's personality was like. In 1985, Mark was actually desperate for cash. He owed a lot of people a lot of money. In this episode, we'll learn more about his most audacious forgery yet, the $1 million con, where he tried to sell a document for over $1 million. Check out our conversation. But before we get to that, I just wanted to mention our Facebook page. Please like our page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. We can have other conversations there, as well as on our blog at gospeltangents.com, where you can comment on these episodes. I'd really appreciate it. Now back to our conversation. So you said you met Mark in a singles ward. Can you tell us what
he was
like?
Well, it was Lynn Jacobs. I was in the same singles ward as Lynn Jacobs, and so we became friends, and then sometime after that, he introduced me to Mark, and then we became friends also. And then eventually I started working with Mark more and more, and then for probably 6 months before the bombings, my full-time employment was I didn't work for Mark, I just worked with him.
So what are some of the things that you did with Mark?
Well, by that time, the volume of his forgeries was getting so big that it was starting to cause some questioning. And so what he did, unbeknownst to everybody, it's always unbeknownst to everybody, he would start shuffling off or kind of shunting off some of his document dealings to other people, so that it didn't look like that he was constantly selling everything. So as an example, Lynn Jacobs was the person who dealt the Salamander letter. Mark Hoffman never did. It was always Lynn Jacobs. He was the one who said he found it, and he was the one who approached the church, and he was the one who approached Steve Christensen. It was never Mark.
Huh, I thought he had a meeting with President Hinckley. Is that not?
Well, he did meet with President Hinckley, but not on that particular document. People have confused that over the years. And it's just, you know, they're just not paying attention to the details. It was always Lynn Jacobs. And he did that, and he told Lynn, I'll pay you to do this, you know, I'll give you a part of what we get. But what we didn't know was he was trying to make sure that it wasn't him that was coming up with everything. So one of the things that I did with Mark is he had several items for sale, and he wanted to sell them to a collector and a dealer in Las Vegas. Well, I was the one who flew to Las Vegas, offered the items, sold them, got the cash, brought it home. And I did that on a trip to New York one time also.
Now, New York was where he found the Oath of a Freeman, is that right?
Well, that was a story he concocted, and it was very ingenious.
Just for, in case people haven't listened to my Kurt Bench interview, tell us what Oath of a Freeman is.
Okay, very important document, and if the legitimate one is ever found, it will be incredibly expensive. It is the first known printed document in what is now the United States of America. A printing press was brought from England over to America, and it was operated by a guy named Stephen Crane. And he was the first professional printing press printer in the United States. The first item that he printed was a single sheet of paper called the Oath of a Freeman. The fourth one is actually known, and there are copies available, and it's called the Bay Psalm Book. But that Oath of a Freeman, very interesting, because what it does is it was printed for the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and it is a way for the people that were participating in that Massachusetts Bay Colony, that religious organization, to essentially sign an oath of fidelity to the new group and say, I'm here and I'm part of this group. And so it starts out, I, and then the letters AB, which are supposed to be for your name, and you say, I will follow the rules of the group, and I'm just very paraphrasing it. You can find it and read it. And the interesting part was, is it said nothing about England. So it turns out, in a strange way, it is the first seed of revolution.
Well, it sounds like it, Oath of a Freeman. It sounds like it would be related to the revolution. So,
well, at any rate, so what happened was, is this interview could go on a very long time. What happened was, is Mark had been to an auction in New York, and on the way home, he was reading through the auction, Sotheby's auction catalog, for an upcoming auction, and one of them was a book that was going to be offered for sale called New England's Jonas, Washed Up on London Shore. It's not that impressive a book, except that there is a text of the Oath of a Freeman. Since there are no known copies of it, nobody knows exactly what words are in it. But from that book, he was able to come up in his own mind what he thought that would be, taking that guessed at text and just modifying it a bit. It was a printed item, but in order to sell that, he needed to come up with a provenance. He couldn't say, I found it on the street, or no one would believe that, you know? I mean, he had to come up with something that people would say, oh, okay. So what he did is he went to a gigantic bookstore in New York called Argosy Books. And they have a whole section of pamphlets. And they, at least in those days, they were just loose. You know, you could just kind of go through them and, you know, one through three, you know, like that sort of a thing. Well, what he did is he took in a piece of paper, and it was actually a poem, but on the top of it, imprinted, what said the Oath of a Freeman. And he looked at Argosy Books' numbering system that have a little letter set and then a price. And so then he took that back to his hotel room and in pencil wrote the correct numbers on it, went back there, slipped it in. Walked around for a period of time, I don't know, 10 minutes, an hour, who cares, doesn't matter. Goes back, pulls that out, goes to the front desk, and with three or four other innocuous items, a $10 book or something, I don't know, but I'm just, you know, $10 book and another little pamphlet or something. Oh, I'll take these. So he gets a receipt. You know, ABC grammar book, Oath of a Freeman, $25. I got it at Argosy Book. Mm-hmm. There's the provenance. And it was a tremendous one because investigators, of course, afterwards went to Argosy Book and said, can you tell us about anything about this? Oh, are you kidding? There's thousands. There's hundreds and a thousand pamphlets and broadsides and sheets and sure, because that's our receipt, and that is a legitimate receipt, and they can find the cashier that wrote it. That's all true. Where did we buy that from? Who knows? How long have you had it? Who knows? So it just disappears in the mist, but as far as he's concerned, it is now out of his hand and to a legitimate source.
Wow, that's amazing. So you didn't have anything to do with that transaction at all?
No.
That was all him. No. What were some of the things you were doing in New York?
Well, he was a substantial collector of children's book and ephemera. In fact, that's where a large amount of the money in the last 2 or 3 years before the bombings, he was making a lot of money, and people have always wondered, well, where did that money go? It went to these children's books. And he had, and the excuse was, he said he was buying it for his wife. And that kind of made her feel good, you know. But he was buying just premium first editions of Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, Call of the Wild, you know, Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz, you know. And he was paying, you know, $15,000 for this book and $8,000 for another book and $20,000 for another book. That's where the bulk of that money
went.
So
he was building up his own legitimate library.
Very legitimate library. And so I would travel with him sometimes because sometimes he would carry cash. And so I was actually the one that would carry the cash. I mean, I've went to New York with $15,000 wadded up in my pocket. And there was one dealer, Schiller and Wapner, who he dealt with all the time, and they were very friendly with him. And at the same time, he would go to auctions, and so I went to an auction at Sotheby's one time and saw the Emancipation Proclamation, one of the copies, no, the 13th Amendment, being sold. And if I recall correctly, I know one of the people I'm sure of was the bidder. It went way past reserves, and it came down to two bidders. One of them, I believe, and I'm going to say this, I believe, because I just can't be 100% sure. The other bidder I know for sure was Malcolm Forbes, and he was the one that eventually got it. He was bidding against, I believe, Ross Perot.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. They were making $50,000 jumps at each bid. And you could tell that Ross finally thought, this is stupid. And from the look on Malcolm's face, he didn't care.
Wow.
He would have kept going until he got it, and he got it.
Okay, so he had a big interest in children's books. So that is what happened. All the money did that get liquidated after he went to jail?
Actually, before.
Before.
Before. And let's see. I'm going to try to say this nicely. Not everyone that dealt with Mark was disappointed in the transactions. We only nowadays and afterwards hear about the people that were disappointed because the money was taken. Some people were not disappointed in the transactions because as pressure was building in 1985 and debts needed to be paid and he needed to find ready cash, he found a couple of people that were willing to make him loans and sometimes some substantial amounts of money, $50,000, $25,000, and use those books as collateral. Well, after the bombings and he went to jail, they kept the books.
Oh, okay.
And they made a really good profit.
Oh, wow. So he didn't, well, I know he did, it seems like he did cheat, was it First Security Bank out of $180,000? Or do you know that story?
I know that story intimately. First Interstate Bank. Right towards the end, he was floating around that he had come upon what he called the McClellan Collection. There was a possibility that William McClellan, one of the early apostles of the church that became disaffected, had a number of church documents in his possession, letters, things like that, plus his own journals and reminiscences. And after he left the church, they just stayed with his family. That is the idea. And he said that he had found a descendant of William McClellan that still had the bulk of this collection. No one had an inventory of it. So no one knew if it was 20 pieces or 30 pieces or 100 pieces. It was just, you know, quite a number of pieces. But in it was three just stunning pieces. One was additional papyri from the Book of Abraham, not the three facsimiles that we see, but other parts of that same scroll. And then he had floated around that there was a history of produced by Oliver Cowdery. And that Oliver Cowdery history contained a letter from written from Emma Hale to, I believe, Oliver Cowdery, describing how the Book of Mormon plates were initially found. And in it, he told people that she said that it was Alvin Smith that went to the grove and prayed, that it was Alvin Smith that actually met Moroni for the first time. And then Alvin died, and then Joseph just took it over and took over the story. Well, it turns all out none of that's true. And it was actually Mark who made that whole story up. But you can see why. What could have been something of just passing interest now is of intense interest. Well, Mark was out of money, and it had nothing to do with the McClellan collection. And he was in some real financial trouble. And so one of the ways he was trying to solve that problem was telling people he had this McClellan, he had access to it, but he would need money to get it. It needed to be $185,000. Well, that information was passed on through from Steve Christensen to Hugh Pinnock. Hugh Pinnock was on the board of directors of First Interstate Bank and arranged a loan of $185,000 to Mark to take, supposedly, and immediately go and purchase that collection and bring it back. I sat in the car, in his car, while he went upstairs to First Interstate Bank, came back down, and I saw the document and the check. And that was an unsecured loan. There was a big box, and I mean, there was a box, and it was clearly marked unsecured. Well, he didn't buy the McClellan collection. The money went to somebody else to pay off some other scheme he was in the middle of. And of course, that was one of the things that provided so much pressure, because eventually that loan, I mean, I can't say this from an accounting standpoint, but it was a somewhat irregular loan, you know, and they wanted it back.
Well, so I know Kurt Bench said that he got a cashier's check for $100,000. Do you think that part of that $185,000 went to Kurt to pay off?
Oh, very well could have. Very well could have. And it was in those kind of amounts of money. This wasn't $200 or $500 that you could kind of, you know, you had in your sock, in the sock drawer or something.
So he was robbing for security to pay Kurt, and yeah, because I know Kurt got a call that said that some people were very upset saying, where did you get that money from?
Yes.
And very interesting.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Shannon Flynn. In our next conversation, we'll talk about how Mark fooled a lie detector test. Shannon Flynn describes a lot of details in how polygraph tests work.
But the way that particular polygraph works is, it isn't like true or false. I mean, what you see on TV is a bunch of hooey. All it does is tests physical responses under stress to questions. And a good examiner will get the person really stressful, so that they react strongly physically when they're telling an untruth.
Click here to subscribe, click here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some other videos that we've done here on YouTube. We hope you'll use this as a valuable resource to learn more about Mormon history.